from WXXI News in Rochester. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson, and this is Connections. Our connection this hour was made last year when author Cheryl Strayed was in Rochester to receive the Artifact Award from SUNY Brockport. Her memoir, Wild, made the New York Times bestseller list for the tale it told of her solo journey up the Pacific Crest Trail after her mother's death and her divorce. Now the book has been turned into a Hollywood movie starring Reese Witherspoon. The movie opens December 3rd. Here's an encore of my conversation with Cheryl Strayed for May of 2013. So let's start by telling a little bit of your story. And typically when we have an author in here, I kind of start going through the book. And I was reading the book and thinking, wow, this is a lot to go through here because there's so much that you lived in these months and years leading up to your decision to set off by yourself and go hiking for 100 days in the middle of California, in the middle of the summer. You lived through, you know, first and foremost what you describe as sort of your narrative birth experience almost, the death of your mother when she was 45, mm-hmm. The breakup of your marriage, a heroin addiction, an abortion. And here we are talking about this. And I mean, these are all very real things. And you've been talking about them now, traveling the country for the last year. I guess I want to start by asking the question of how does it change your experience of those events to have spent so much time 20 years after the fact almost writing about them and reliving them now as you have these conversations around the country?
Well, I think that one of the beauties of writing is that you do get to look back on your life, especially when you write nonfiction, so you're drawing from your own experiences and turning them into literature, is that, you know, my mission is always artistic first. But it is true that when you do examine your life that closely, as you have to do when you're turning your experiences into essays or memoirs or what have you, that you really have to think about, well, who was I? You know, how do I accurately portray that person I was at 26 when I decided to take that hike? And what's the perspective I can bring on that now as somebody who's 44? And so in that process, it's incredibly enlightening. I understood things about myself that I could only have understood through the writing process. And then the weirdest thing this past year, where I have talked to thousands of people about the book, is they tell me, it's not so much me understanding myself anew, it's readers telling me what the book meant to them, what they saw in the book, what they perceived about me. And so that's been enlightening as well, a really fascinating process.
You've been, you know, some people describe this as sort of an out-of-the-blue bestseller, and it really isn't, because you've been writing for years and years and years, and people who are fans of the Portland nonfiction scene have known you for years, people who read The Rumpus have known you for years. Is it weird all of a sudden that it's gone beyond that? Now all of a sudden here you are, you're talking to Oprah. You're sitting at home one day and Oprah calls.
Yeah, that wasn't expected. You know, it's true. I'm as I said, I'm 44 and I have been a serious writer for a long time, really since I was about 19. And even before that, I'm one of those people who, from about the age of 6, as soon as I could read and write, I knew I wanted to be a writer. And really was committed to it by 19. And so this is something that I've done for years. I published my first book, which is a novel called Torch, in 2006. I got my MFA in fiction writing at Syracuse University, just down the road.
Just down the road and from us. With George Saunders.
George Saunders was
a phenomenal crew there.
Yeah, George Saunders was my mentor at Syracuse.
Someone else who all of a sudden is getting a whole lot of attention, even though he's been around doing this.
I know. You know, I had breakfast with George in New York back in the fall, and I just, you know, right before his book came out, and I just had this sense that, okay, this was going to be the book. And then when that collection of his, The 10th of December, appeared on the New York Times bestseller list, I think all the writers in America celebrated. It's so wonderful to see a short story collection on the fiction New York Times bestseller list. But so, yeah, I think that like George, you know, I certainly was known in the lit community in the United States, you know, and a lot of people did read my first book. But what's happened with Wild is this really strange occurrence. It's almost like lightning striking. And so I don't know how to explain it or what sense to make of it, really.
It makes it challenging in some ways to do a show like this, because there's one group of people listening who have, you know, already been turned on to this and know the story and know the book. And there's a group that we hope we can, introduce you to them and tell them a little bit more. I guess one place to begin perhaps is simply with your name, because you were not born Cheryl Strayed. That's a name that you chose for yourself not long before you set off on this journey.
That's right. As you mentioned, so my mom died when she was 45. We were both seniors in college. Your listeners read Wild, it explains how it was that we came to be going to college at the same time. And she died on the Monday of our spring break of our senior year. And I, at the time, really, my life came apart the day my mom died. Life as I knew it ended.
This all came upon you very suddenly.
It did.
My mom, long lingering kind of.
Yeah, my mom had cancer. She knew she had cancer for 7 weeks. She went from being really a healthy woman to dying very quickly. And it shook my whole life. It destroyed my family. I was married at the time, and I just couldn't sustain that relationship. I was too young to be married anyway, but I certainly couldn't do it in the face of such enormous grief that really knocked me down entirely. And so it came to pass that I was getting divorced at the age of 25 or 26. And I knew that, you know, my ex-husband and I had taken on each other's names. And so when I was going through that divorce process, I knew that I couldn't go back to that name I had as a kid. Cheryl Nyland was my name growing up. And I had to really, I knew so much of what the direction I was moving in was all about trying to find my path, trying to define who I was and in some ways redefine who I was. I'd made a lot of mistakes at that point. And I was really flailing, again, to be that person my mother had raised me to be.
And you're absolutely unsparing. I mean, I was amazed reading through this. You don't get on the trail until, 70 pages or so into the book. And just reading the description of how you were falling apart and the things you were doing to yourself, to revisit that this many years later, did it open up new wounds, or were these things that had been inside of you all along that needed to get out onto the page?
Well, as somebody who has been a writer all these years, these are things that I've been writing for a long time. You know, Wild is not the first time that I ventured into that territory. A lot of people read Wild and say, how could you have been so honest?
But no, you've been there. I've been essays.
And I've been writing essays. It's because
I'll talk about sugar in a minute, too, because that's a whole piece of this.
Right. It's a muscle that I have worked over a long period of time. And I think one thing that happens is with writing that does, you know, and I will say my writing does tend to be fairly raw and fearless. People have this feeling when they're reading my work that they know everything about me. And what I can say is I do pretty fearlessly tell the truth about a whole bunch of parts of my life. But there are also things I don't, there are also parts of my life I haven't written about, you know, that there's a difference between knowing me in person and knowing me on the page.
Are there pieces that you'll never write about?
Yeah, absolutely. Not so much about myself, but the people in my life who I love and care for. I think one of the biggest challenges, probably the biggest challenge of being a memoir writer, is that you inevitably have to write about your family and write about your friends and your partners and your children. And there's a lot of consideration about that. My siblings, for example, have big stories, and I haven't told them, and I probably never will, because I wouldn't want to invade their privacy.
And you get into some of that, this whole thing. The night before your mother dies, you're trying to get a hold of your brother.
That's right.
Who's coped with this. I mean, was that just a coping mechanism that he just disappears for a while?
He did. And so, yeah, it's true. In Wild, I do have to say some unflattering things about my brother. I was careful about what I said, but it was true that he was not there for my mother when she was dying. And there was no way around that truth. Another person I write about is my biological father, who was abusive and tyrannical and violent, and there was no way around that. And what I did is I told what was necessary. And a lot of people ask, how is your brother? What did your brother think of the book? And what I can tell you is that book transformed him and our relationship. When he read Wild before it came out, he was so moved by it. And what he said is there was so much that's in the book that he had just completely buried. And reading the book split him open. And we had the most profound conversation of our lives because of it.
So certainly something else valuable that came out of this process.
That's right.
you've approached, you know, it was interesting reading Wild first and then picking up your collection. We got to talk about Sugar. We can't not talk. I've been dying to talk to you about Sugar.
You just want me to call you Sweet Pea.
That would be okay. I'm okay with that. For about 2 years, just after you finished writing Wild, you took on an advice column that sort of existed but didn't really have form to it yet and needed to be fleshed out. And you really fleshed it out and created this alter ego named Sugar, who for most of this time was at least nominally anonymous.
Yeah.
And answering these questions that were coming in sometimes this very raw, very there, very almost brutal fashion. Talk a little bit about the experience of being Sugar and about the experience particularly of being Sugar, knowing a lot of the stories that you're telling. To me at least, it sort of seemed in some ways like a sequel. Oh, okay, now I see where she went after some of these events in Wild. Knowing that after the fact, now that you've come out
right
and acknowledged that you were Sugar. What's the experience of doing that before people know that?
Well, the whole Sugar experience has been just absolutely fascinating to me, because I never thought of myself as an advice columnist. I wasn't much of a reader of advice columns. I would read Dear Abby or Ann Landers or something in passing when it was in front of me. But when I was asked to do it by Steve Almond, who was the writer who originated the column, I thought it really sounded interesting. And in so many ways, even though it seems at face value that I'm ill-prepared for the job. I didn't even take psychology 101. I've never gone through therapy in any proper fashion. I went to a couple sessions once. But what I realized once I got into it is that my work as a writer was what had prepared me. Because what does a writer do but contemplate very deeply for a very long time what it means to be human? And not just what it means to be human, but what does it really mean? You know, who are we actually? What are those faces that we conceal and reveal and construct? And I think everything about giving advice has to do with that, looking at people's problems and sorrows and secrets with the kind of complexity that a fiction writer would have to look at a character when building him or her, or a memoirist would have to look at once and herself when writing that book. And so I applied all of that, everything I knew as a writer and a human, to those answers I gave as Sugar. And in Tiny Beautiful Things, you'll see, it's not just 20-somethings asking about love, though there are letters like that in the book, but, you know, middle-aged men asking about, you know, dysfunctional children and people asking about jobs and all
senior
kinds of
topics.
Senior
citizens looking to find love in their 60s.
That's right, yeah. I really wanted that column to be that, to be about all of human experience.
And a lot of it ends up being about your human experience.
That's right.
Because sort of if you can identify a default Sugar mode of answering a question, it seems to be, let me tell you this story about this thing that happened to me or to somebody that I knew.
That's right.
And here's what I learned from it, and here's what you can learn from it. And oh, by the way, you're really strong and you can pull through this and you'll survive. One of the pieces that really touched me as I was reading through it is this guy who writes to you and says, I'm ugly. I'm not attractive. I don't think I can ever find anybody to love me. And you go on to tell the story about this man that you knew who had been burned terribly, mm-hmm. and had gotten a settlement and ended up becoming very wealthy and able to do whatever he wanted to. And then that sucker punch that mm-hmm. you deliver at the end of it.
Mm-hmm. That he killed himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because he could never find love. He was my a dear friend of mine. I call him Ian in the column. And he believed that no one would ever love him because he was ugly. And this letter writer in the column you're referring to was not just ugly. He was actually physically deformed. And he said, nobody will see me as a sexual being. And my friend Ian said that same thing. And so one of the things that I do a lot of Sugar is it's almost like those letters are a writing prompt in some way. So here is this man who has a physical he's physically deformed, and he writes to me and says, will I ever find love? And what I think about is my friend Ian and his journey from able-bodied, attractive young man to burn victim, really burned severely over most of his body, to somebody who said, I refuse to even look for love, who then kills himself because he's so alone in his life. And so I'm presenting this story in some ways. I do think that none of us really want to listen to know-it-alls. None of us want to be told what to do. I think that a more powerful way to convey and enlighten, convey meaning and enlighten, I guess, one's circumstance is through story. I believe in story. And so as Sugar, I'm telling stories. Often they're stories from my own life. So Tiny Beautiful Things does end up being like a jigsaw puzzle of a memoir as well. My husband, who I call Mr. Sugar, is a running character in the book. You learn about my kids and my decision to become a mother and my feelings about all of these different issues arise in the columns over time.
Your kids, actually, before we get to that, I want to have you just read a little bit of this answer, because there's a lot of Sugar that we can't read on the radio.
Sugar loves the sacred as well as the profane.
Oh, does she love the profane? We can't even, I'd love to quote the motto, and the best we can do, I think, is
but
to
we
say,
can't.
Write like a...
Something
really powerful.
So
yeah.
Which one do you want me to read?
The over on the right-hand page there, down the middle. That middle paragraph there was the one that...
Okay. Anyone who has lived in the world for 26 years looking like what he is, a broken man, is not just average on the inside. Because of that, the journey you take to find love isn't going to be average either. You're going to have to be brave. You're going to have to walk into the darkest woods without a stick. You aren't conventionally attractive, or even, as you say, normal looking. And as you know already, a lot of people will immediately X you out as a romantic partner for this reason. That's okay. You don't need those people. By stepping aside, they've done you a favor. Because what you've got left after the fools have departed are the old souls and the true hearts. Those are the uber cool sparkle rocket mind blowers we're after. Those are the people worthy of your love.
You internalize these stories as you're writing about them. You write several times about you're up at 3 a.m. thinking about these people who have written to you and who at this point are entrusting their deepest concerns in somebody who they don't even know who they're writing to.
I become sort of obsessed with the letter writers, it's true. There were so many times that my sorrow was close to unbearable, the sorrow and concern I felt for those letter writers. When I was a little kid, my sister is 3 years older than me. And whenever we were out playing, if she would fall and scrape her knee or get hurt in some way and cry, and our mother would come running to us, what would happen is I would start crying too, but I would usually cry harder than my sister because I was so upset that she was hurt. And my sister would become furious with me because she thought I was, you know, just trying to steal the attention. So what would happen is my mom would come up and she would think I was the one who was hurt and hug me. And my sister would say, "You're just trying to get attention." But that wasn't true. What was really true is I felt her pain so profoundly, it felt like my own. And I remembered that when I was struggling with so many of these emails I receive. I still receive them. I'm not right now writing the column.
What's Sugar's status right now?
It's in hiatus. Yeah. I didn't expect this last year to be so demanding in terms of what I've needed to do for Wild, and as well as Tiny Beautiful Things. And so I've sort of put it on a break, but I think I'll come back to it. And people still write to Sugar. I read the letters. I don't answer them in the form of a column, but perhaps I someday will. It was really an experience, though, that it fulfilled, I think, so many aspects of my mission here on this earth, you know, all of my passions. It combined those things, the writing, which I'm so passionate about, and also my desire to actually help people and make a difference in the world. And so that was a pretty stunning experience to have, you know, every day still people come up to me, every event I do, somebody comes up with that book in their hands, with Tiny Beautiful Things, and says, "This is the column that changed my life."
Is it going to be different if you go back to writing these as Cheryl, not just as Sugar?
I don't think so. I've written a couple as Cheryl. Here's the deal. I knew when I took on the column that I was going to reveal my identity someday. So I never wrote the column anonymously. People experienced it as anonymous because they didn't know who I was. But everything I wrote, I only wrote it if I would stand by it as Cheryl Strayed. As I sort of alluded to earlier, there are all these kinds of things I could write about the people in my life, all these juicy stories I could tell if I knew that they would never be, you know, their privacy would never be invaded. So I always was very careful. Anything I said about people in my life, for example, my husband, there's one column where I write about him being unfaithful early in our relationship. And I talked to him about it. I was still anonymous at the time, but I said, look, we're going to be public about this eventually. How do you feel about it? And he was very supportive, but I was always conscious that Cheryl Strayed would be on those columns.
Author Cheryl Strayed in an encore of an interview here on WXXI from May 2013. It's Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. After the break, more from Cheryl Strayed about turning her very personal memoir into a Hollywood movie.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Thanksgiving is about rituals. We asked you about yours.
Some hay meat and canny eat.
We're together. That's what matters.
While everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree.
Moments of Holiday Grace, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
Thank you for the eyesight to see and the courage to say what I see. And the creativity to say it with eloquence.
Thanksgiving Grace was always eloquent from Maya Angelou. We'll remember her and gather together with poet Nikki Giovanni and a Minnesota blessing from Garrison Keillor. I'm John Burge with music and stories for Thanksgiving. It's Giving Thanks from American Public Media.
Thanksgiving afternoon at 1 on WXXI.
It's Connections on member-supported public radio. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. And this is an encore of an interview with author Cheryl Strayed, who visited Rochester last year. Her memoir, Wild, comes out next week as a movie starring Reese Witherspoon. Strayed received the Art of the Book Award from SUNY Brockport. I asked her what it's like to talk to audiences that might not have read her books yet. When you give these presentations to large crowds, and again, you're walking into a room, sort of like the virtual room that's around us right now, where you know that some of the people have read every word that you've written and want to know every piece of this story, and some of them are walking in and just know the very basic outlines. Maybe they saw you on Oprah, let's say, or heard you on the radio. How do you approach those two audiences when you're giving a speech like you're going to give tonight?
Well, I think that the most interesting thing when I go to see a writer is I want to hear the story outside the book. We can all take that book home and read it. And so tonight I'm mostly going to talk. I'm going to read little snippets, but I'm really going to tell the kind of bigger story that goes behind the writing. And, you know, of course, in some ways I have to, that doesn't require me to explain some aspects of Wild for the people in the room who haven't read it or Tiny Beautiful Things. But it's sort of a deeper experience, I guess, than you might get just holding the book in your hands and reading it.
There's that connection. I mean, there are certainly books where you can read them and get done and not know that much more about the author when you get done. You get done reading Wild, and especially if you follow it up knowing that background and you read Tiny Beautiful Things. And you mentioned there are these wonderful little sort of gray pages in Tiny Beautiful Things where you provide the backstory to that then and explain, here's what I was thinking when I wrote this, and here's some questions that you might want to know the answers to.
Right.
And one of those things that you mentioned is that people, when you're on this tour that you've been on never-endingly now for over a year, want you to come to their homes and want you to have dinner with them.
Yes.
Stick around. How do you handle that sense that people have that connection and yet you still got to separate from that a little bit?
Right. Well, I'm so grateful that people feel that they have a connection to me through my work. I think that is the highest calling of literature, to make us feel less alone, to make us understand that we're connected to each other. And I certainly know that those books that I read and have read throughout my life make me feel connected to my fellow humans, those are the most important books I think there are. And so I just feel grateful that other people feel that way about something that I've written. I feel like I'm part of this incredibly beautiful circle of writers who have come before me. And so it's an honor. It's an honor that they feel connected to me. And most people actually know how to set a really good, healthy boundary around that. They can look me in the eye. Sometimes they weep or cry or tell me they're nervous, and they just tell me thank you. And they sometimes tell me a story from their own life of why they feel connected to this piece or that piece of something I've written. And that just feels like a gift to me. It doesn't feel like a violation at all. Some people do think, okay, we're going to be best friends. And that's always a little bit more challenging. And it isn't because I don't want to meet new friends through my work. I think that could be a really interesting way to meet a friend. I've certainly read books. When I read Mary Carr's Lit, I thought, I want to know this woman. I did know this woman by then already, but I had that feeling that you want to be, you know, when you want to be somebody's friend through their work. But of course, I can't be everyone's friend, you know, and so I have to just graciously say, you know, I'm going to have declined that dinner invitation.
Is it weird? Do you regret sometimes if you'd known that this was going to be as big as it became, putting that much information out there and letting people know, you know, what state your thighs were in as you're walking down the trail and they're getting chapped, and who it is that you're thinking what about as you're meeting them on the trail?
You know, there's nothing I regret having written. There's nothing that I regret at all. And I think that I had a lot of fear before Wild came out. In the couple months right before Wild came out, I started to get a sense that, you know, more than like five people were going to read the book. And that terrified me. And I thought, what have I done? And I really wanted to go back in time and not have written that book and have written a novel instead about a woman hiking on a trail. Because, you know, even, I mean, you're still vulnerable in fiction. But in nonfiction, you know, there's no screen. You know, you're saying, this is me. This is really a story from my life. And so I don't regret anything. And so the big surprise for me in this last year has been how kind people are. Are there nasty people who have written nasty things about me on the internet? Absolutely. But they are so far outnumbered by the people who have been so loving and kind to me. And I mean, I can't even begin to tell you how much that has restored my faith in who we are as a people. You know, there's fewer crazy people, it turns out, than you'd think.
Although you met a few of them along the way.
I did.
There's that wonderful sequence, you know, just as you're getting all wrenched up, reading an incredibly moving sequence as, you know, as you're flashing back to something that happened with your mom. And then all of a sudden, you know, you've got that little bit of humor. The guy you ran into who was a correspondent for the Hobo News, which apparently is a real thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, and so many people have said, it was called the Hobo Times. And they say, well, did you ever find if he wrote that article about you? And I looked when I was writing the book, and I could see that they did exist. You know, I don't know if they still do. It seems like that they exist intermittently, which maybe wouldn't surprise us since it's maintained by hobos.
It also
turns out the hobos are awful at archiving. So if he wrote about me, I do not know. I think he didn't, because I think
We should explain. This is something that happened. There were points where you had to get off the trail because the weather was not going to let you get through some of the high peaks in the Sierras.
So right.
You're off the trail, and this guy mistakes you for being a hobo.
Well, and granted, I was hitchhiking. I was trying to hitchhike around a section of trail that was completely snowed in. There had been more, it was a record snow year the year I hiked. And yes, he mistook me for a hobo and wanted to interview me. He was very excited because I was a woman. And apparently it's very, really hard to find hobo women, as he told me. And so I had so much fun writing that scene. And I think one of the things in the scene is he keeps saying to me, asserting that I'm a hobo, and I keep telling him, no, I'm hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. I'm a long distance hiker. And I do think that by the end I had convinced him that indeed I was doing what I said I was doing.
There's so much connectedness in the book, you know, even if it is your journey alone from California up to Oregon, there are so many people that you meet along the way and so many people whose progress you're following. Even if you're by yourself, you're aware there are people behind you. You're aware there are people ahead of you. To what extent are we not getting in the book the extent to which you really were by yourself for long stretches of this?
I was really by myself. It was very common to go two or three days without seeing another human being. That was the most common scenario. And so oftentimes, you know, then it would be punctuated with me, you know, coming to a rest stop and seeing people in a little town or meeting other hikers along the way. Or sometimes I would hike through a more populated area where there were day hikers. But even then, you know, it'd be like an hour or so stretch where, you know, when people go day hiking, they go in like a 3-mile radius from a road. They're not really all over the trail. And so solitude was the most common state that I was in. And one of the challenges when I was writing Wild was writing solitude and writing, essentially, I was getting up and I was doing the same thing every day, all day. I was getting up and I was walking and I was eating pretty much the same kinds of foods and pitching my tent and all those things. And so the challenge of like, how do I convey the monotony of this without boring the readers to shreds. And so I think, you know, those scenes when I did, you know, when I did meet somebody, they really are pretty, they stand out in the narrative because I think the reader is like, yay, there's another person to talk to instead of this woman talking to herself in her head.
Or singing.
That's right. And singing in my head.
Or the mixtape that you talk about, which is a very 1995 thing. And this happened probably in I'm thinking sort of the last few years in which you could be that much by yourself without really working at it. Because I imagine the hikers who are up there now, they've got cell phones with them, and they've got iPods with them.
I mean, we could go online right now and find hundreds, maybe at this point thousands of trail journals that people have kept, and often uploading them right from the trail. I was on the PCT last summer in Oregon, and I tweeted from the trail. I'm on the PCT. It was thrilling. It was also depressing to me. In 1995, I didn't even know what the internet was on, what the internet was. You know, I knew that that was this weird thing that existed and that like five people in the whole world were on it, but nobody I knew was on it, and I didn't know what it was. Same with cell phones. I first heard about a cell phone on the trail. Somebody explained to me that he was carrying this prototype of a cell phone. Actually, the guy I call Albert in the book, he was carrying this big brick of plastic with numbers on the front. And he said that this company had asked him to carry it and turn it on once a day to see if it ever got reception. And it never had. So he was going to dump it in the PCT hiker free box. And I remember distinctly sitting around all of us saying, that's an idea that's never going to fly, because who would want to carry a telephone around with them all the time? You can see why I'm a writer instead of in product development.
Absolutely. Is it possible still, if somebody wants to be this away and to have an experience like you did, can you still do it?
Well, I think it's a really complex answer, because of course you can. You can say, I'm not going to take that technology. You'd be constantly running into other people who had that technology, however.
Yeah.
So when I was out there, the only ways to reach me were to hike into the wilderness and find me, or wait till I called you from a payphone that might be at one of the stops that I might be at in a couple of weeks.
Your schedule didn't change somewhere along the way, which it did.
That's right. Or write me a letter in care of, you know, this post office or this gas station or this ranger station. So I was actually alone. When I was in these places, I was often aware that nobody knew where I was, because like you said, I had to change my route at a certain point. And I did communicate with a couple of people about that. But I was profoundly alone. That was real solitude. And I'm so grateful for it. Now, when I hike, I usually have my iPhone in my back pocket. And I don't think that's a good thing. That's kind of sad to me. It's a big thing, you know, once you have that technology to let it go. But I do think that it absolutely changes the way we feel in the wilderness. Like I said, I tweeted from the trail. So then I take this experience where I'm usually feeling very alone, and it becomes a community experience, because within seconds, people are responding to me on Twitter about me being on the PCT.
And you want to know what they're thinking.
That's right. It's terrible, actually.
For an audience.
It's a terrible thing, I think.
And you carried paper books with you, too.
I carried paper books.
You have the list in the back. Which, I mean, yeah, they're just books, and yet you have that list. The books I burned along the way, because you had to, because you had to keep weight out of this monstrous backpack.
I was lightening my load. You know, so many people have written to me and said that they've gone backpacking because of Wild. They were inspired to get out there themselves. But none have yet written to me and said that they burned Wild. I would love for one of them to use Wild as you know, kindling.
That sort of complete the circle, to have the
ashes of it. That's right.
Flowing somewhere. What's been the impact on the trail community? Is there any backlash for saying, hey, we had a good thing going here, don't tell people about this?
I think that, you know, I try to stay off the internet and, you know, stay out of these, you know, whatever raging debates any of my work might bring about. And I'm sure there's a lot of conversation. I'm aware that there's a lot of conversation about it, because certainly my book has brought so much attention to the Pacific Crest Trail. Every, you know, when I do events, I often say, well, how many of you heard about the trail first because of you read Wild? And most of the room usually raises their hands. And so that's kind of interesting, which I think is a positive thing. Like, I think it's really important and powerful that every American knows that wilderness corridor is there for us, whether you ever set foot on it or not. that belongs to us. That's a national treasure that we have. You can walk through the wilderness from the Mexican border to the Canadian border. Isn't that an amazing fact that people before us thought to preserve that and fought to preserve that? And so I love that I've brought that awareness. But I do think some hikers think, well, now everyone's going to come hike it. And what I say is that's a positive thing. I mean, I think people walking in the woods, only good can come from it.
It's a big trail. There's a lot of room.
That's right. That's the other thing. It's a long trail. You know, most people will just go out for an afternoon.
Cheryl Strayed is the author of three books, including the best-selling memoir, Wild. This is Connections on member-supported public radio. You're listening to an encore of an interview Strayed did here at WXXI last year. At that point, production was just getting underway on the movie version of Wild, which comes out next week. I asked her what it was like to see her very intimate book turned into a big screen production.
I think for any writer to have a movie made of their book is just a really strange experience, and especially when it's a memoir, because I read the script. So Reese optioned it. She really wants to star in it, playing me. And the writer Nick Hornby, who I just admire so much, he wrote the script. And I recently read it. And just right there on page one, it was so strange to see the main character's name is Cheryl. Yeah. And I'm thinking, that's me, you know, so that's going to be odd. But I really have a distance, too, from the film. You know, I wrote the book. That's what I did. And the film is another thing altogether.
That's you, but it's a fictional construct of what's already sort of a
that's
construct
right.
that you've created.
That's right.
Of yourself. Where do you go from here? You've got, you said, one more month of this book tour.
Mm-hmm.
And now all of a sudden you're not just somebody sitting at home in Portland writing for a literary crowd there. Are there expectations that you feel on you as a result of the success of this?
I'm sure that there are expectations. I'm sure people who really enjoyed my books, you know, hope that they'll enjoy the next one. But there's nothing I can do about that. You know, I mean, I can't write to please people. And so I think what I'll do is what I did with all three of my books to date is that I went to that really private, silent, mysterious place that a writer has to go to figure out what is that next story. You know, you referred to my grief and my mother's death being this theme really in all three of my books. And you're right. It is something that has obsessed me as a writer. I think that many writers don't necessarily choose their material. Their material keeps asserting itself in their work. And one of the things that I'm really curious about, and I'll wonder, I don't know if this is going to be true, but I think that in my next book, that mother loss and grief is not going to be a big part of it. Now, I could come back here in a couple of years and talk to you. And you could say, wait a minute, you said, and the whole book could be completely about that. I don't know.
You just wrote a cookbook about it. What's
exactly.
going on here?
That's right. But we'll see. I mean, I think it will be something I return to again and again as a writer. But I think that the next thing, I'm interested in other questions. And you know, I'm sort of going to cleave to my other obsessions in my next book. I don't know if it's going to be a novel or another memoir. I'm sort of leaning toward a novel just because I'm so completely and utterly over myself at this point. It would be nice to write about somebody other than me.
In a way, Tiny Beautiful Things sort of approaches some of that by answering some of those questions of, okay, what happened next? Because it seemed to me in getting to the end of the book that, you know, all of a sudden it ends. You get to the Bridge of the Gods where you're heading at the Columbia River at the border between Oregon and Washington. And you get there, and you've already met up with your friend who you're heading to live with in Portland, and you sit down next to a lawyer in a BMW, and he's eating an ice cream cone, and then that's sort of it. And there are a few paragraphs very, very briefly sketching what comes next.
Right.
But you kind of wonder, anytime you've had a big experience like that, I know if I come back from something big and life-changing, there's that next morning where you wake up, and all of a sudden you're just sort of sitting in bed, and nothing's happening. It's like, what was that? And I almost wanted to read that next page of, okay, then the next morning I woke up and here's what happened.
Right. Maybe I'll write that someday. Certainly a lot of people ask me about that transition. One of the things that happened is that I asked that question. You know, here I was, I had had such a big experience in the wilderness by myself, and suddenly I was back in the city. I was living in Portland and I was looking for a job as a waitress, and I was, you know, I was back essentially in the same life that I had before, only I was profoundly different in ways that were were very subtle to everyone but me. You know, I had righted myself. You know, I had been really on the wrong course. And I found my strength again, the strength that had always been there. And so I just was able to throw myself more clearly and truly in the directions of things that I really cared about, like my writing, being a better person in romantic relationships again. I met my husband. I met the man who's now my husband 9 days after my hike on the PCT, and we fell in love. We didn't. We were together four years before we got married. We both had some more growing to do and some things to work out. But really, in so many ways, I think I walked to this next part of my life. I walked to that really important and beautiful relationship I have with my husband, and we have two children together now. I walked to the woman who could become the writer that I have become. And so much of what I learned on the trail was sort of formed the foundation of those things.
And you're right, there's another passage in Tiny Beautiful Things where you're responding to the guy who's trying to decide whether he wants to have a family. And he's already into his mid-30s, if I'm recalling correctly. And he's laying out, you know, I see I could go in this path or I go in that path. And you really lay it out to him and say, write it down and figure out, you know, this is what your life could be if X. This is what your life could be if Y. And at the same time, you're somebody who, you know, on the one hand, yeah, you knew you were going to be a writer. And you came out of this knowing you're going to write. You had no idea that it was going to become something as enormous as it has become. I guess the question that comes out of that is, to what extent really can you know, and how much is just sort of holding your breath and jumping when you're making decisions like that, when you're making a decision to have kids, as you've done in the last few years?
Yeah. Well, like I say to that man who's writing to me about that, you know, we don't know. When I got pregnant with my first child, I had very mixed feelings. You know, I intentionally got pregnant, but my husband and I were like, well, I hope this works out. I hope we like the baby, because we weren't convinced that we were, you know, baby people. It wasn't until I had that boy in my arms 9 years ago that I understood that I'd done absolutely the right thing. But that doesn't invalidate the idea that if I had chosen that other path and decided not to have a baby, that I couldn't have an absolutely fulfilling and wonderful life. And so that's what I was trying to say to this guy. I mean, I think all of our lives, it's this combination of, you know, leaping, you know, just closing your eyes and leaping, and also just trying to think things through, trying to really look at yourself, take a long view. The reason my husband and I had, you know, decided to have a child, now we have two children, but the whole reason we decided to become parents was that we thought of ourselves at 60 and 70 and 80. And we thought, do we think at that age that we'll have wished that we had kids? And the answer was yes, even though at 35 and 40, we didn't want kids, but we thought we should do this. We'll be happy we did.
And you write in Wild about imagining your mother being in her 80s and 90s and still tending her garden and having to accept that, no, that's not a path that happened and there was nothing that you could do about it. And you're approaching that age now. She was 45 mm-hmm. when she died, and you will be soon. Do you think about that a lot, or just when people on the radio ask you that question?
I think about it a lot. I've the way I've thought about it has changed. When I was younger, I was convinced that I would die young. And maybe that's in some ways why I was so self-destructive too, you know, after my mom died, that it didn't seem to matter if I did die young. And then, you know, I went through this phase of feeling like, I'm going to get a terrible disease. I'm going to get cancer like my mom and die. And I'm still afraid of that. I think, you know, we all have those fears, but I've sort of let that go. I'm about to outlive my mother. If I turn 46, that's something my mom never got to do. She never got to turn 46. And I hope that I do, and I plan to. And I'll be really, really thinking about my mom on that day in a really full, deep way.
We were talking a little bit before the show, and the comment came up that it's a shame that your mother couldn't live to see you do all this and how proud she would have been. And yet again, it's that divergent path where if she had lived, you probably never would have written the book. And you probably wouldn't be sitting here now. And in a way, you've also brought her to a lot of people who never would have known her. Is that something do you think as you're out there telling these stories that you're preserving her in that way too?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the most curious questions, I agree, you know, okay, I would have never written these books, but I would have written other books. And that's what's fascinating to me. Grief, mother loss, cancer, death, all of those things have been so enormous in my work. And what I wonder is what would I have written had my mother lived? It would have been something. It wasn't that I wasn't a writer. I was a writer. You know, it just would have been something else. My body of work would have meant something else to the world and to me. And, you know, people used to say, you know, I mean, when my mom died, I used to always feel so strongly that I couldn't imagine my life without my mother. That was impossible for me to imagine. And now my mom has been dead longer in my life than she was alive. Just this past year, we crossed that line. And I can't imagine my life with my mom in it. You know, I carry her memory with me, but I can't imagine my life took such a turn when she died that it's like, that ghost ship life I would have had if she were alive, that writing career I would have had, you know, it's a mystery to me. It doesn't exist. And I think that in so many ways, what I wanted when my mom died, well, the first thing I wanted was my mom not to die. And so in so many ways, what I did is I brought her back to me in my work. And I not only brought her back to me, I brought her to the world. So many people feel they know my mom because of my books. The other thing I wanted was to not feel so alone. I really thought, I knew rationally I wasn't the only person whose mother was dead, but I felt alone. I didn't know anyone else whose mother was dead. And through my work, I've met thousands of people who have come to me and said, I understand exactly what you wrote. What you wrote, the book of me. You wrote my sorrow. You wrote my loss. And that's, you know, really powerful to me.
And yet you've had that ability as a writer to find this way to process it and to find these ways to deal with it and to make something bigger out of it. How does that help the process? Do you feel fortunate as a result of having had that venue and that ability to cope with it that way, especially as you look at the way that your siblings dealt with the same story in their own different ways?
Mm-hmm. I do think that writing can be really healing. You know, I think I said earlier, my intentions are always artistic. I'm not turning to writing for therapy, but I don't think that there's anything wrong with doing that. And what ends up happening is there's nothing I've ever written that hasn't ended up being incredibly therapeutic to me, because the process, I mean, it even sort of parallels what we do in therapy. We go, you know, you sit down and you think you have the story. And then as you go deeper into the story, more of the story is revealed to you, parts that had been in some ways unavailable to you at first glance. And the deeper you go, and the more vivid you make that moment or that character or that whatever it is, the more you understand about who you are and who we are. And so I do think that it's been a great blessing to me that I have my writing. I think my writing has absolutely saved me, without question.
Do you get that impression from, you mentioned that your brother had read the book and had mm-hmm. you had had these conversations. What about your sister?
My sister is not much of a reader. And she didn't read Wild until just a couple of months ago.
Really?
Which I think, people think that sounds like she was like trying to avoid the book or something, and it's just really not the case. She just isn't a literary person. She's not a reader, and she just wasn't really interested in reading the book until recently. And she said she liked it.
What about your kids? Are you seeing literary talent?
Oh my
goodness.
And
are you trying to encourage it?
No.
And I say this as somebody with a very literary 9-year-old daughter, too, so I have a personal...
That's right. Well, I have a 9-year-old, too. My son just turned 9 a couple days ago, and he is such... Both of my kids are such book lovers. I have a boy and a girl, and they love to read. I have a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old, and they love to read. And just a few months ago, my son, Carver, who's named after the writer Raymond Carver, said, I want to start keeping a journal. And this was not something my husband and I, you know, pushed at all. We did. We went out and bought him a journal. And every night, After he brushes his teeth and has his bath, he sits on his bed and he writes in his journal. And it's the most adorable thing. And of course, it just kills us because we want to read every word. And he says, please don't read my journal. So we're trying not to violate his privacy. But we did get him to show us a couple pages. And it's so amazing what he's doing. Here he is. He's doing exactly what a writer does. You know, he writes about what happened, and then he goes deeper and he writes about how he feels about what happened. And sometimes he'll draw pictures to accompany it, and it just moves me deeply.
And they'll read these books eventually. Are you comfortable with how much they'll know about you after reading them?
I think that there's...
Does anybody want to know that much about, about their mother?
No, you know, of course there are going to be scenes in the book that it will take them, I think, some time before they're really ready to read. You know, I think that we all go through this process as we grow up of coming to understand that our parents are actually humans. They're not just there to serve us or to be, who, you know, our mother or father. And so when they reach that point of maturity, which, you know, might be into their 30s, really, they'll come to my books. And what I really think is that they are so lucky. Who among us would not want to have a book our parents wrote that offered us a view and to who they really are, and to who they were before we came along? And so I think that, yeah, some of those scenes will make my kids squirm, and they'll just glide right past them. I think the more important thing is that those books are really a document of the truest version of me.
What are you going to do when this tour is over? You're heading to Europe now after this. Is there a point where you just, can you stop and just say, I'm not gonna write for a little bit. I'm just going to process. Or is it just in you to have to get right back into writing?
Well, it's, yeah, I'm my husband and I are looking to purchase a cave somewhere, and we're going to move in and then put a stone in front so we could be just completely alone. But no, what the opposite is true. What I really want is get back to the writing. I don't need a break from the writing. I need a break from talking about the writing. And so it's been glorious to do that. I mean, what an opportunity. And thank you so much again for having me on. But what I do need to do now is just find again that voice, that quiet voice in the writer's mind that allows me to write more.
Author Cheryl Strayed joined us on Connections in 2013. The movie version of her best-selling memoir, Wild, comes out next week. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson. He'll be back on Monday. Thanks for joining us here on member-supported WXXI, WRUR, and WEOS.